Today on The Rest Is History, the Ripperologist's question of questions. Who was Jack the Ripper? We will be exploring all the various suspects who have been proposed. We will be evaluating them. And at the end of the show, we will be naming the kind of person or the person we think was most likely to have been Jack the Ripper. Subject to survey and suitability. Hive app compatible with selected technology. Paid for surplus requires SEG tariff.
Your physician in ordinary to the Queen, entrusted with the well-being of the heir to the throne. Only you had reason to believe that these unfortunates, these whores, these traitors destroyed your life's work.
Below the skin of history are London's veins. These symbols, the mitre, the pentacle star, even someone as ignorant and degenerate as you can sense that they course with energy and meaning. I am that meaning. I am that energy. One day, men will look back and say I gave birth to the 20th century.
Crikey. So that's Johnny Depp and Ian Holm in the film From Hell, which was released in 2001. And our thanks to the studio for giving us that authentic audio recording. And From Hell is an adaptation of the comic book by Alan Moore and Eddie Campbell. So the first person speaking, played by Johnny Depp, was Inspector Frederick Abberline. And he is confronting the man he now knows to be Jack the Ripper, who is not a poor labourer from the East End or a Polish Jew or an American cowboy or any of the other theories that were so popular in the newspapers in 1888. The second man speaking there, played by Ian Holm, was a man at the very height of the British establishment, a man who has masterminded a conspiracy to cover up a scandal that would have brought down the monarchy and perhaps the British Empire itself. Tom, you a fan of that performance there? Do you think that was a good performance?
Yeah, it's a huge fan, and particularly of Ian Holm's black eyeballs, which he has by this point in the film. And he will come to a horribly sticky end.
Maybe we shouldn't give away who he's playing.
We shouldn't, but we will reveal in due course. And I think it kind of illustrates the way in which the story of Jack the Ripper is so sensational, so melodramatic, that people want a solution that is as sensational and melodramatic as the crimes themselves. The idea that it could just have been some random psycho, and perhaps particularly a random psycho from the same streets as the victims, is not something that people really want to contemplate. They want someone who is spectacular, dramatic, preferably famous. And I guess that explains, doesn't it, why ever since the Ripper seemingly vanished into thin air after the murder at Miller's Court in November 1888, people persist in coming up with solutions. And I mean, it has to be acknowledged that decades and decades have gone, solutions and solutions have been presented, and no one yet has come up with anything that has been accepted as definitive, has it?
No, not at all. And I think your point about the search for meaning, for the solution to have a sort of deeper meaning, actually reminds me of the series we did about the murder of John F. Kennedy. So remember when we did that, we were saying, you know, for conspiracy theorists, the idea that somebody so powerful could be shot and killed in an instant by a nobody, and it might not mean anything. There's no conspiracy behind it. It doesn't tell you something about the inner workings of American democracy or capitalism. That's unbelievably frustrating. You know, it feels like you're waiting for the end of a story and the end never comes. And so with the Ripper, people want it, I think. People love the idea that it has a suitable killer to match the melodrama of the moment, and that killer must tell us something about the anxieties of the age or the secret workings of Victorian Britain or whatever.
Well, I think it does, actually. And we'll be revealing our own solutions at the end of this show. I mean, I think it does, but I don't think it's kind of about the operations of high society or anything like that. I'm just going to put that up front. But of course, the other contrast with the JFK assassination is that, I mean, people may dispute that it's Lee Harvey Oswald, but there is clearly a suspect who stands centrally and that I think most people would accept did do it. That's the difference. So to quote Philip Sugden, who we've been referring to a lot throughout this series, because his book, The Complete History of Jack the Ripper, is really the definitive survey of the case. He writes about the quest for the identity of Jack the Ripper, and he says just up front, where anything at all bearing upon the killer's identity has come to light, it has proved at best inconclusive, at worst downright fraudulent. In this context, those who hunt the Ripper are vaguely reminiscent of the Spanish conquistadores, those foolhardy adventurers of four centuries ago who, driven by shimmering visions of El Dorado, cut their way through steaming jungles or toiled across burning deserts to find at their journey's end not the riches for which their souls longed, but clusters of dirt villages or desolate plains. Has to be said, Dominic.
Yeah.
It doesn't stop him from going through the list of suspects. And it's not going to stop us, is it?
No. And I can promise the listeners, you will not get dirt villages or desolate plains. You will get cities of shimmering gold at the end of this podcast, because we will go through the suspects, won't we? We will discuss them one by one.
As the discussion turns to the chilling cases of the murderer in East London, a crucial point emerges: the respect for the victims and the weight of their stories. This sets the stage for a deep dive into the infamous murders. What details will illuminate the peculiar patterns of this killer's actions?
And I think after this episode, people will say, case closed. It's done.
Would you like to remind people of what it is we're investigating? The salient details of these extraordinary series of cases.
So this is what people need to keep in their heads, right, as we go through the suspects. We're looking for somebody who killed and mutilated about five or six women, we can't be certain, in the East End of London in a very short period of time, August, November 1888. Now, to remind people, all the murder sites are in a very narrow area. They're within one square mile of the East End and the City of London. So as Sugden says in his brilliant book, the assumption surely must be, not least given the way the killer was able to escape and to evade witnesses and whatnot, to get away without being seen, and to move in the night when he killed two people, to move so quickly between one location and another location, the assumption must be that he is a local man one way or another. Either he lives in the area or he knows the area extremely well.
Or he's a spectre or a phantom.
Right. In other words, if you think, well, he lives in a palace some miles away, you know, you've got a bit of explaining to do. Now, there are multiple witness reports. Let's assume that maybe some of these witness reports are of the wrong person, or they're fabricated or whatever. Even if that's the case, there are still enough of them, I think, to have a rough idea of the kind of man who's been seen talking to some of the victims. A white man. Average or below average height, in his late 20s or 30s. Most people, not all, but most of them say he's kind of shabby genteel. He's, you know, he's not a laborer necessarily. He's not covered in the dirt of his trade, so he's not obviously identifiable. But he's not wearing a top hat and wearing an opera cloak and so on and so forth.
He wears the dark clothes of a working man who perhaps is coming away from or going to a place of work.
Yes. He's probably got a moustache. There's a lot of accounts that say he's got a moustache, as so many people do. And there are multiple accounts that describe him as wearing either a peaked cap or hat or a deerstalker hat.
So, I mean, another salient fact perhaps is the days of the week on which the murders take place. So Polly Nichols is murdered on a Friday. So that's the early hours of a Friday. Annie Chapman, early hours of a Saturday. Liz Stride and Kate Eddowes, early hours of a Sunday. Mary Jane Kelly, early hours of a Friday, but that Friday is a bank holiday. And just to throw in Martha Tabram, the first victim, she's murdered on the Tuesday morning after a bank holiday. So all of those murders in some way are, you know, they are at a weekend or kind of adjacent to a bank holiday, which again, perhaps suggests that this is a person in regular employment.
Right, because you can't commit murders if you're at work, right? And not only that, the killer is striking generally between the hours of midnight and 6 o'clock in the morning. That would suggest that the killer is somebody who probably is not married, does not have children, or at least has some kind of arrangement that will allow him to go out and desert his wife and children overnight.
Or has a job that requires him to walk through Whitechapel in the early hours of the morning or come back from a job.
So one other thing. The police made multiple inquiries in the lodging houses and doss houses in the streets surrounding the murder sites, and they didn't find a single man there who seemed to fit the bill. That would suggest that this man either lives with a family, So he could live with his parents, for example, or he lives in his own rented private lodgings. In other words, he's not another person living in the DOS houses because he would have been caught. Let's get to the killings. I think the killings undoubtedly show that the man has some degree of anatomical knowledge.
So cutting out the organs and things and all of that.
The cutting out the organs. I'm going to give myself away here. I don't think I would have the capability to cut out somebody's organs. I wouldn't know what I was looking for. I wouldn't know how to do it. He does. So he's familiar with a knife and how to use it, and he's familiar with the innards of the human body, or of a body, anyway. Finally, I think we need to consider why the crimes ended when they did. I mean, this is a massive question, isn't it? We were actually talking about this with the team before we started recording. Why does he stop? Because if you've been escalating and beginning more and more of a kick from doing these terrible things, you're not just going to give it up.
It's not unknown, is it? So there are examples of the Zodiac Killer.
The Zodiac Killer is an example. There was the so-called Monster of Florence. There are big gaps and hiatuses, but it is very unusual. It's more likely that the killer would stop because he died. He might have taken his own life. He might have emigrated. He might have been imprisoned for some other crime. We just don't know.
And I think all the more so for the fact that if we include Martha Tabram in the list of the people that he murdered, the mutilations are of an escalating ferocity, which implies a kind of gathering frenzy. So that is also something to bear in mind. Oh, to the suspects. We are going to begin with the ones that we have labelled mad theories. So these are suspects that have been presented as kind of serious suggestions that we nevertheless think basically are lunatic.
Go on then.
So I'm going to begin with what I think is the single maddest theory of all. And it was proposed on the 24th of November, 1888, in an edition of a magazine called The Advertiser by an unnamed antiquarian who, and I quote, had been consulting an old historical manuscript. And he writes, "It seems that there was an old monastery in the 16th century on the spot where Mitre Square is now situated." So Mitre Square is where Catherine Eddowes was murdered. "As was not uncommon in those days, the morality of the monks was not of the highest order. And in addition to many other crimes, one of the fraternity put the finishing touches to his wickedness by murdering a woman whom he had smuggled into the monastery at the foot of the altar. A curse was pronounced on the spot, and it was on the same place where the altar used to stand that the unfortunate woman, Eddowes, was murdered. The writer of the story asserted in his letter that there is a plan of the old monastery in the British Museum which enables the spot to be accurately identified." So, Catherine Eddowes was murdered by a curse that dates back to the Middle Ages. The obvious flaw in this theory is, what about the other ones? There's no answer to that, is there?
No, there's no answer. I mean, that's bonkers. That is bonkers.
So I think we can dismiss that one out of hand.
So that's those ghosts of a monk or whatever. But what about people who weren't ghosts? So there are a lot of famous Victorians who end up being dragged into this story, aren't there?
Before diving into the theories surrounding Walter Sickert, it's crucial to understand the intriguing connections between his art and the infamous Jack the Ripper case. As the conversation unfolds, listeners will explore Sickert's controversial paintings and the shadows of speculation they cast. Could these artworks actually contain hidden truths about the Ripper's identity?
No, she said he used to go out a lot at night, and I noticed he went out on the nights of the killings. Of course, if Sickert was the Ripper, he must have concealed a wry smile at that. Then in 1908, he painted a series of pictures called The Camden Town Murder. So the Camden Town Murder was the murder of a prostitute called Emily Dimmock, and she was murdered in her lodging house bedroom in, I think, 1908. And the case was very much in the news at the time. And Sickert's pictures, the pictures in this series show a man who's fully dressed sitting on a bed next to a naked woman. Now, some critics think that actually they weren't really pictures of the Camden Town Murder. The Sickert was a great self-publicist. He had a brilliant eye for getting people's attention. And that actually he painted the pictures and then came up with the title afterwards to explain them. Anyway, that's a kind of side note. Patricia Cornwell and her people who believe her theories believe that these paintings actually depict the murders of Catherine Eddowes and Mary Jane Kelly. That Sickert arranged the characters in the pictures to mimic the murders, and that these are his little clues, and he is kind of taunting us with his knowledge of his own crimes. Now, the thing is, if you look at the pictures are not as graphic and gory as you might expect from my description. They actually, if you Google them, they feel kind of sad and shabby and kind of melancholy. They do not feel to me like the works of a man who eviscerated his victims in a frenzy.
I mean, and if it's Mary Jane Kelly, they certainly don't replicate the horror of her dismemberment.
No, not at all. And actually, there's a, I mentioned it a couple of times, there's a brilliant website. I mean, this is the kind of rabbit hole down which you fall and you will never come back up again, called the Casebook, I think, a Jack the Ripper Casebook or something. And there's an essay on this website by a guy called Wolf van der Linden, all about Sickert's art and whether it relates to the Ripper. And he points out that Sickert painted prostitutes in Venice in 1903, and he wrote afterwards how much he enjoyed doing it. He loved working with them, these pretty, obliging little models who laugh and unembarrassedly be themselves while posing like angels. It's an uninterrupted joy to paint them. And van der Linden says in his essay, "This doesn't sound like a serial killer talking about his victims. This is actually a bloke who's just like, you know, he enjoys their company and is having fun and he enjoys their hedonistic, uninhibited ways. He's not tortured with self-loathing or loathing of them when he's doing it, right?" Now, you mentioned stamps and George V. Patricia Cornwell got some DNA from a stamp licked by Walter Sickert, and she compared it with the DNA in the Ripper letters. And she said, there's a match here. There's a definite match. Actually, the match, you know, as much as 10% of the population could have this same DNA.
And the letters are hoaxes, almost certainly.
And if the letters are hoaxes, which they probably are, then that doesn't tell you anything.
So I think DNA testing is a kind of, it seems like a massive opportunity for ripperologists, but there is barely an example of it being used that doesn't come across as mad.
Exactly.
I think it's a kind of a terrible temptation that should be resisted.
There are a couple of other big problems with the Walter Sickert thesis. Number one, Walter Sickert lived until 1942. Is it plausible that he carried out these killings in an escalating frenzy and then just stopped and never did anything like it again?
Youthful jeu d'esprit.
Yeah, we've all behaved badly in our youth, haven't we, at times? The other thing is, Walter Sickert lived on and off in France during the late 1880s, and his biographer, Matthew Sturgis, says, you know, I'm pretty certain he was in France for at least four of these killings, which I think is insuperable. The one thing I will say, however, I noticed that in the studio chat of this podcast, Aaliyah, who is herself German, says, never trust a German. So maybe that we should put that into the balance as well. And maybe she's right and Sickert is the culprit.
But if Aaliyah is German and says, never trust a German, you can't trust her.
It's the Cretan liar, right?
Anyway, on that paradoxical note, I think we should take a break. We've looked at the mad theories that I don't think anyone really believes, except perhaps from those who propose them. And we will be back after the break to look at some of the suspects who are more credible, perhaps. Throughout time, celebration has meant giving. So the Romans at Saturnalia handed out all kinds of gifts.
To grasp the chilling theories of the Whitechapel murders, understanding the role of the local knacker's yard and its workers is crucial. They operated at night, making them potential witnesses or participants in the horrors that unfolded. Enter the unsettling world of the slaughterhouse, where the lines between brutality and murder blur.
So you boil the bones down. This draws out the fat, which you can then use as axle grease or to oil harnesses. You can use it actually to oil cricket bats.
Once you drew it.
Yeah. And then the bones are used to make, I don't know, cutlery or carriage interiors or whatever. And the hooves are used to make glue. And the stench of this is so vile that they can only be boiled during the night. And therefore, because of this, people working in knacker's yards have to work around the clock. And so there are shifts, and slaughtermen are, you know, a matter of course, you will see them walking through the streets at night, either arriving for a shift or leaving a shift. And we know that there were three slaughtermen who were working at Barber's Horse Slaughterhouse on the night that Polly Nichols' body was there, because we have their names because they went to view the corpse. And these are James Mumford, Henry Tompkins, and Charles Breton. And they gave the details of their kind of movements that night at the inquest. And they said that they'd started work between 8 and 9 p.m. So the previous evening, so that's the Thursday. They'd finished it at 4:20 a.m. on the Friday morning. So that's around the time that Polly's body is found. And also at midnight, they said that they'd left the slaughterhouse and they'd returned around 1 a.m. and they didn't leave again until they heard about the murder. So what that suggests is that precisely the time when Polly is murdered, a slaughterman, someone who would be absolutely adept at cutting up a carcass, would have been leaving the yard that is right next to the murder site. If he lives eastwards, he would have gone down Hanbury Street. That would have been the route he would have taken. Annie Chapman is the next murder victim. So I think that is entirely possible, that someone who is working in that knacker's yard, I mean, there's a reason why he'd be carrying knives. There's a reason why he might have blood. He wouldn't be walking around with his butcher's apron on, but he would, you know, he'd have a heavy coat on, and that might correspond to the coat that is seen by witnesses. And just to say, again, I have no real knowledge of the psychology of serial killers, but two points that is kind of folk wisdom. One is that people in childhood or in their youth display an interest in the torturing of animals. They often go on to become serial killers. And I could imagine a case in which, you're a child, the thought of dismembering an animal excites you in some way. And so you find a job in a slaughterhouse. I mean, it would be an obvious career for someone growing up in the East End, so why not? And then perhaps you reach the stage where you think, well, what would it be like to dismember a woman? And the process of murder, as we said, escalates. And the other thing, it comes from a 2009 study by a criminologist called Amy Fitzgerald, and she noted that people who work in slaughterhouses relative to workers in other interests have a disproportionate number of arrests for violent crimes and sexual offences.
Really? That's an interesting fact.
So, I can't give a name, but if I had to name someone if I was Inspector Abberline, I would have, interrogated the workers in that knacker's yard quite intensively.
So that's disappointingly similar to my own view. I don't think it was any of the people we've named, just to be clear. I think it's somebody who will never be known. And to remind people, I think it's somebody who lives in the East End. I think merely being there for a few months is not enough. I think you need to know it. You need to feel confident within that world. I think it is a man in his late, between, let's say, 28 and 35 or 40 maybe. I think he definitely has a moustache. I think he definitely wears a deerstalker hat or a cap of some kind. We've mentioned many times markets, and I think he's a butcher. I don't think he's a doctor or even a medical student. I think such people would probably stand out. They're too genteel in that world. I don't think this person comes across as mad, because there are too many descriptions of them talking, sometimes joking or whatever, with the women before they're killed.
That's all for today. Visit podsummarizer.xyz and start creating summaries of your own podcast in just seconds. Don't miss it.